Los Angeles. He walks again by night. Out of the fog, into the smog. Relentlessly. Ruthlessly.
I wonder where Ruth is.
Doggedly. Toward his weekly meeting with the unknown. At 4th and Drucker, he turns left. At Drucker and 4th, he turns right. He crosses MacArthur Park and walks into a great sandstone building.
Oh, my nose!
Groping for the door, he steps inside. Climbs the 13 steps to his office. He walks in. He's ready for mystery. He's ready for excitement. He's ready for anything. He's...
Nick Danger, Third Eye.
I want to order a pizza to go and no anchovies.
No anchovies? You've got the wrong man. I spell my name Danger.
What?
The makers of fantastic cigarettes, long in the leaf and short in the can, bring you another true story from the tattered casebook of Nick Danger, Third Eye. Let's join him now.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for The Magic Word, and today my guest is Dan Garrett. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Scott.
Great to have you here, and now you are on the lecture tour and crossing the country.
That's right, at least the Midwest and the South a bit, yes. All new, although the material isn't necessarily new, the presentation of this lecture is new, and I'm rejuvenated. I'm excited about giving it. It's a good mix of some things I've put in print that I never really performed for people that much or put in a lecture, and then some things I've been doing on my own and only put it in a limited number of places.
Right.
So now it's more widespread, but everything I put in the lecture, I've refocused on rewriting all the scripts, mm-hmm. redoing all the presentations, and it's a work in progress still, but the more I do it, the better it gets.
Well, you've done about almost 2 dozen lectures, seems like, on this
pretty
tour.
Close.
So quite a few. Now, you've lectured all over the world. Japan and across Europe and everything. And so have you had some place that has been a specific memory to you, I guess, that kind of stands out that you...
I have good memories from all of those.
Sure.
And certain things are they're usually sometimes the first time. I'll never forget the hospitality of the magicians in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
Yeah.
You know, very hospitable. And I have friends, you know, down under. That was fun. Australia and New Zealand.
Right.
And Japan, you're treated, if you're a guest invited to Japan, you're treated like royalty.
Wow.
So I think the first time I went to Japan, I went along with Roger Klaus.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a trip and a half there. A lot of fun, a lot of stories I could tell.
Oh.
At the Hakone, it's a close-up convention in Hakone, Japan.
Where is that in relation to Tokyo? I know where Tokyo is. So is
I'm not exactly sure geographically. I know that the first night we stayed in a ryokan, which is a traditional Japanese inn where you sleep on the mats and the floor.
Oh, take off your shoes. And,
yeah, and then you have a communal super hot bathing area.
Uh-huh.
You know, and the Mike Skinner line, we're here because we do card tricks. Look at all of this. Because of magic tricks.
You wouldn't be able to be here if it just wasn't for the deck of cards. Now, as you were learning magic, I don't know that everybody really can appreciate how good a chops that you've got as far as your technical skills. Because I think that you're kind of a master at really hiding those skills.
Well, I think there are two schools of thought on that. Magic can be like juggling where you want to show off some of the skills.
Sure.
But I'm the school that thinks that magic should happen as it go on.
Right.
So I try to approach it that way most of the time.
Mm-hmm. One of the, I think, cool things that you do is just with the cards. Oh, name escapes me a minute. Whether you're showing one card and then you can peel one off with the hand.
Yeah, so one-handed swivel. Okay. Steve Beam called it the Ulta Garrett knuckle-busting pyramid triple swivel change of death, something like that. And then some of that application of the lateral palm is from Baltazar Fuentes from El Paso. I know also Hollingsworth. It was influenced by my lecture to do a lot of his amazing things.
Mm-hmm.
And then Leonard Green has taken the lateral palm independently of me or anyone else and done some really incredible things.
Now, you have met Steranko?
Yes,
and
I've met
him
a couple of occasions.
Tell me something about him, because he's kind of a mysterious guy in magic, you know?
That's right. He is well known in the art and comics world as an artist and writer of comic books, in particular Spider-Man and others.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very famous. He's almost like a god.
Stan Lee, almost, yeah.
Yeah. not Stan Lee god, but he's pretty much a,
he's up there.
A god in that world. He was in magic for a while and then got out of magic for many years. He dropped out completely through an unfortunate incident that occurred between him and a rather well-known magician that ripped him off, according to Stranko. So he said, I don't need this.
And yeah, dealer in particular? Or it doesn't matter who it was, but I mean, it was just he got ripped off by something.
He was a very famous creator and inventor and performer of magic.
That took an idea of his?
Card magic, yes.
Interesting.
I probably shouldn't say on the podcast.
No, of course, but I just was wondering why someone of his caliber would have quit. Because it seems like, I thought, didn't he do escape artistry as well?
I wasn't aware of that.
I thought he did some, but maybe I'm just thinking of some of the pictures he's drawn. Or
he's very, a style of all of his own. It's almost recognizable.
The graphic.
His type of work.
Right.
But he was also amazed because... I met him once at a comic book convention, and David Ginn was there. Had a copy of Genie magazine with Stranko on the cover, one of his designs, and had him autograph it. And Stranko, somebody gave him a deck of cards, and he did Vernon's cutting a Magician versus Gambler.
Oh yeah,
with a deck that he had said I hadn't touched a deck of cards in 20 years, and yet the trick he chose to do for the layman was something of that difficulty: Magician versus Gambler.
Right.
And he did it almost perfectly, not to me 100%, but amazingly. So if he really hadn't picked up a deck in 20 years, I was impressed.
Well, yeah, when you stop and think about someone who has that dexterity with their hands to begin with, that he is such an excellent artist to also...
Question as to why these relate so well to magic.
Well, that was what I was going to get to also. It has to do then with the with Martin Gardner, that you've got to be friends with him before his passing and had attended many of the gatherings for Gardner, and he certainly was someone who was involved with puzzles and that kind of, and mathematics, and so...
Oh, precisely. He influenced a lot of people in a lot of different areas. That's why they have the gathering for Gardner every 2 years in Atlanta, because he got all these people started in their field with his writings on recreational magician long before I became a magician.
Right.
I knew about Martin Gardner from his recreational mathematics.
Well, I knew him first, of course, from the Encyclopedia of Impromptu Magic. You know, that was one of the first books that I had received in magic after I got my introduction through Tarbell. Then my next one was his tome on impromptu magic.
A big tome, and I heard rumors that he had enough material to write a second and third volume of the same size of Impromptu Magic in his notes. I don't know if I don't know if anyone can make sense enough of the notes to do that, but hopefully someone will try, because I'm sure it's a treasure trove.
What was he like, actually, to sit down and talk with him?
He was a very quiet and easygoing person, a very intellectual, but he was not a performer that would be bombastic or extroverted. He liked to watch a good performance, but I never saw him perform too many magic things. He would show a puzzle or something. And the first time I saw him, I knew a lot of puzzles and stuff, and he was showing me. He'd show you something that looked like something you already knew.
Okay.
So you'd be really nice, and you're sort of smiling. And
going right along, yeah.
And then, bam, it would be something you had never seen before, and he would just reel you in. He loved to do that sort of thing, I think.
Right. So he was really kind of low-key type of a guy then.
Yeah, but he packed a punch with his ideas of things that would just amaze you.
Right.
He called himself a gatherer of information, a researcher. He said he wasn't really a mathematician.
Right.
And there are many people who would argue with that.
Certainly.
Because you have to understand something to write about it.
Right. Well, he had several books on mathematics, I believe. That's
yes.
As well as science. And
He was a very modest person, but he really was an amazing person, too.
Now, did he teach also? Don't know what he did for a profession.
Sure. Yeah.
He was an
he was a writer, professional writer. He wrote so many.
Right.
That's how he made his living.
Through the books that he published.
Yes.
Oh, I see. Now, another fellow that comes to mind when I think of him
is very prolific, too, by the way. I'm not sure how many books he's written, but it's an astounding number. It's Asimovian in its scope.
That is the most amazing guy, Isaac Asimov, I should think. You know.
And they were friends.
Really? Did you ever meet him?
No, I never
did. I know, because you're big into science
fiction
and everything then, too. Percy Diaconis. Am I pronouncing it Diaconis?
Diaconis, yeah.
Diaconis. Did you ever meet him? Because it seems like, did he come to the gatherings as well?
Yes, that's the only time I met him. I met him at one of the gatherings for Gardner. Mm-hmm. Math professor at Harvard.
Right.
Wrote his doctor's dissertation
on
the Pharaoh Shuffle.
Oh, I did. Okay.
Yeah, and or the mathematical aspects of that.
Right. Now, for the gathering of Gardner, you said that all types of people from different walks of life, specifically, I guess, who were just interested in mystery or mental challenges, of whether that it was going to be puzzles or magic. I mean, what other type of people? I mean, did they have?
Well, the gathering of people specifically that are mathematicians, teach mathematics. John Conway, legendary genius in mathematics, who created the computer game called The Game of Life.
Okay, sure.
Which is, he says he's probably responsible for more wasted computer processor time than any man in history.
Okay.
People writing these programs of the subvariations of The Game of Life and running them on these mainframe computers all the time.
Yeah.
And immediately, they'd be above the heads of the super other mathematicians there.
Wow.
Would say, I don't know what he's talking about.
But did you always feel that you had learned something, or was it just something that you
were amazed? Oh, no, you always learned something. I mean, it was kind of an environment to be put in that is a dream for someone like me who likes to learn new things, because you can't go to one of these and see a presentation, and just about everyone up there is going to show you something you've never seen before.
Was this the beginning of the TED Talks, would you say?
Well, it could be. Yeah, it could be. I mean, that type of thing. This has been going on for almost 20 years, though.
Yeah. But were they small and short presentations, kind of like the TED things?
Yes, right. They're presentations usually with either computer or that start out with overhead projectors. Mm-hmm. And the mathematicians and puzzle people would give the talks. And the magicians would do a show, would do either a close-up show or a banquet show as part of their presentation. They perform.
I see.
But these are like, I think they were limited to, it got to be a point where you had to limit yourself to 7 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you went over, they got kind of angry.
And was this by invitation only as far as the gathering?
It is by invitation.
Mm-hmm.
But if one would be interested, of course, the organizer died this past year, Tom Rogers.
Okay.
And he was the real impetus behind keeping it going in perpetuity, hopefully, and run by some other people there. So you can go to G4G.com, I think, Gathering for Gardner, the last one was G4GX, Gathering for Gardner 10. The magicians are coordinated by a well-known magician from New York, Mark Cetaducati.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Cetaducati is the creator of a lot of different mathematical puzzles and games that are sold to toy companies.
Mm-hmm.
So they get paid, he's like the Tenyo guy of the United States, the guy who creates these type of magic things.
Mm-hmm.
He's an amazing, amazing person. And
I heard him lecture at the Magic Live, I think, last time.
Well, you're lucky. I haven't heard him lecture, but he's, I've just known him enough and seen him talking to him.
Gave a bunch of examples and showed the books and things and how he put these things together, and it was fascinating.
Yep, and he's a very creative guy.
Yeah.
Takes things that we know about, but he puts them together in commercial ways that I would never think of. And I say, well, I wish I'd thought of that. He's I wish I'd thought of that kind of guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. How many people actually attend? Do you say, since it's invitation, is it limited to the size of the venue?
Usually they hold it at the Ritz-Carlton, and the rooms there are not the cheapest
in Atlanta.
In Atlanta. And
mathematicians are rolling in money.
I said, do you know how much money magicians have compared to these mathematicians and people? So 200 or more or less is about the right number.
Okay, so just a little bit larger.
Hey,
than
Leonard Green comes all the way over from Sweden every time to do this. We used to have regulars. Jay Marshall used to be a regular before he passed on. Jerry Andrus, a regular.
Right.
Max Maven has been to a few.
Right.
And then Percy Diaconis to a couple.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, more recently, we've had Mark Mitten doing some, Danny Orleans, myself, John Rayling from Chicago. I don't want to leave anyone out, but there are a lot of magicians.
Just kind of a handful of magicians in comparison to everybody else, it sounds like, then. We almost are on the perimeter.
but there have been a who's who of magicians that have attended this.
Uh-huh.
Jamie Ian Swiss, over the course of their 10 gatherings, over 20 years, since it's every other year.
Uh-huh. Okay.
They just had the 10th one this year. And so it's been a who's who if you listed all the magicians who've attended.
It's usually in Atlanta, or they. It seems
it's
like
always been in Atlanta.
Well, I thought whenever that Martin Gardner was in Oklahoma, that it moved there for 1 year. No?
No.
No, okay.
No. But there is an event that is now more widespread held in October called a Gardner Celebration of Mind.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to try to do things in different locations every October for this, hold events that have to do with mathematics and puzzles and magic as a homage to Martin Gardner.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the Martin Gardner Celebration of Mind.
And being a past president, national president of the Society of American Magicians.
But don't let that fool you. I can still do a little magic.
That's what I was going to say. That it seems like that a lot of the presidents, past and present, have various magic skills or have not been full-time professional. But since you've gotten out of college, you have chosen magic as your full-time profession.
Yes. Several years out of college, I was able to convert
and you
into
were
full-time.
Physics? Is that right?
I have a degree in physics, yeah. But that wasn't the work I did out of college. I did computer data entry, very boring kind of thing. But I was a very fast typist, so I made some money and to survive. Got married right out of college.
Mm-hmm.
And then my wife supported me on my first couple of years being a full-time magician.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I would probably have starved to death.
A successful spouse as well to help supplement your income.
As I tell people who ask for advice, I say, have a wife who works.
Good advice to the young, yes. And talking of computers and that kind of a thing, did you ever get involved with computer programming of any games? I mean, I remember some of the early games that were kind of where you would go into a room and you have to type in, you know what I'm talking about. You type in saying, okay, I want you to go into this door and pick up the axe. And then they would say, okay, well, did you ever program any of those kinds of?
No, not particularly. I tried my hand at a few.
What do they call those?
Adventure games.
I guess, adventure games. Yeah. Okay.
The basic early days. Nowadays, and of course, I've always liked RPG, role-playing games.
Okay.
I play Warcraft, as a matter of fact, for the people who know what that is.
Tell me something about I don't play Warcraft. But
World of Warcraft is a MMORPGH, whatever. Mm-hmm. Massively multiplayer role-playing game worldwide. There are hundreds of thousands of players worldwide, and there's so many that you can't have every game on one server. So they have hundreds of different servers, each with
worldwide.
Their own
wow.
game. It's the same. It's a whole world. Mm-hmm. And it's role-playing because it's fantasy.
Sure.
You can play any number of races, characters, professions. You have different skills, spells, or fight bigger monsters or go on quests.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get stronger and stronger as your character develops.
So it's like a video game, basically.
Yes, but you play online, and it's just an
against
awesome,
other characters.
You can fight other characters who are playing, or you can fight characters in the game.
Okay.
Or monsters. There are all kinds of monsters. That's what makes you stronger, and you get money and gold that you can spend.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of real-world things in an auction house that you can find things and or make things and sell to other players for gold.
Right.
And make money for
the game. Don't they have conventions? I know that.
I'm sure they do.
Yeah.
They do. And there's Warcraft conventions plus Warcraft subparts of science fiction conventions and gaming conventions, and like the Dragon Con in Atlanta is one of the big ones.
Okay.
And they have a whole subset of gaming,
even board games, books. I guess, like Magic.
Yes,
for example.
Absolutely. All kinds of board games, strategy games, games that you probably never heard of, only gamers know about.
Right, right.
Steve Jackson games, you've probably never heard of those.
No, I haven't. I know Richard Garriott.
Richard Garriott, yes. Well, I started out playing a lot of his games for the Apple, too. One was a Caliboth, and it was a dungeon crawler. Mm-hmm. And later he developed the Ultima games, Ultima. Ultima 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, that's where he made his big money.
Mm-hmm. And isn't he known as something he has?
Yes, he's programmed these under the name of Lord British.
Right.
And for those listeners that don't know who Richard Garriott is, he is the first commercial space traveler. He paid, I don't know how much money, millions or something to the Russians to be shot up into space and to be a space traveler
without
being an astronaut or work for any government. He was the first paid commercial space traveler.
And he, I think his father was an astronaut.
Maybe so.
Space,
yeah.
You know, he gave us a lecture at the TAOM a few years ago, and he was talking about that he almost didn't get to go. As I recall the story, that he had had LASIK surgery or something, and so they didn't think that they were going to be able to send him up into space. Well, they did, and so he was the first one, I guess, with LASIK surgery to kind of find out whether or not that this would be okay. You have? And so he actually has broken some ground, saying, "Well, I guess it's okay." You know, they checked him before and afterwards, and he took all the responsibility or whatever.
I didn't know that. I do know, of course, that it takes more than just. I'm sure I do know that it takes more than just having the millions of dollars to pay for your way. There's still physical requirements.
That's exactly
that you have
right.
To pass.
Exactly. Exactly right. But he had, I guess, a family history of being involved with NASA and the space program and everything.
I'm sure that's a plus. That's
yeah,
right.
That's always kind of helpful.
But he's also involved in magic.
In magic,
very,
sure.
Big collector. And
he was on the cover of the MUM magazine.
Yes, yes, he was.
Some years ago.
He performed a magic trick in space, I guess, or something.
He did. Matter of fact, I think it was Brian Brushwood and C.J. Johnson's thing in which that he went up and had a... Oh, some sort of an idea. I forgot. It's online, basically. But he would, you know, call. So he didn't have to actually carry anything with him. He just kind of had somebody, you know, name a card. And then he said, go to this website. And Professor Johnson will, you know, tell you what your card is. And they went to that website. It's really pretty cool. It's one of those scam school ideas that you can go into Brian's website and find. But it was an awesome trick. It's
pretty
cool.
Thanks for the info. I'll do that.
Yeah, it is pretty cool that you can do anywhere, obviously, even in outer space. Mm-hmm. It was the first trick that was done like that, intergalactically, so to speak. And intergalactically brings me then to the science fiction, because I was kind of coming around through that from the back door and talking about gaming and other things like that, that you've always had a fascination, I know, with Douglas Adams' books.
I love science fiction, and I use the ideas from science fiction sometimes to help me create magic.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written a few columns on this in MUM and other places. Mm-hmm. And I think that, of course, I use the quote from Arthur C. Clarke, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And if you think about it, this is this is pretty awesome thought. Because what you've seen today, if you saw Star Trek, I saw that when I was a kid. When it wasn't a rerun, that dates me pretty good. But if you were 100 years ago or even today to see someone vanish or appear in a shimmer of light, that would look like magic to you.
Sure.
And, of course, it's something that in the future, apparently, in Star Trek, it's fairly commonplace. Beam them down to the planet, beam them back to the ship.
Right.
So if you think that audiences would now say that all the tricks we do can be done by electronics, by modern science, by technology, then you have to think like a science fiction writer. You have to go beyond things that are possible from technology now, try to find effects that can't be done with some sort of superconductor circuit and things like that.
It was only a short time, it seemed like, with the iPhone or the iTouch or even before the iPad came out, when people were buying apps, magic apps, that you could actually fool somebody and they'll think that's kind of cool. And then a few months later, they will say, hey, where'd you get that app? So in other words, the trick is being done by the app and not by you. You know, one of the problems that I hear about that, because people are thinking, okay, well, I got that technology. It's kind of like, you know, look
this
at the pretty box.
This type of magic thing has got to be a fad eventually, because 10 years from now, well, will there even be iPhones? Who knows? There'll be something maybe completely different.
Sure.
Make completely change.
Well, the phones to begin with.
Yeah.
The flip phones. Talk about Star Trek. You know, they were based upon the communicating device that they had used.
And now that's so old. You know, that's so 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Which was on Star Trek, the wave of the future.
Well, you remember on the Minority Report with Tom Cruise.
Yes.
You know that, as I understand, that the director of that had brought together a group of consultants to say, okay, what kind of technology will we expect to see within the near future, not the too far distant future, you know? And so they're coming up all these really cool ideas. For an example, like the stuff that you see that we use now with the Apple products, like the iPhone and the iPad, where you put your hand on it, you know, move things around with your with the palm of your hand and whatnot, and other kinds of things that you're starting to see kind of come about. So it was not a huge leap, but it was enough that it was really cool at the time. It's probably, 10 years years ago or so even. And we have gotten to that point for some of that technology already.
Yeah, because another thing science fiction writers do is to create in their mind something that may be feasible, and then some scientist comes along and sees this, hey, maybe I can really do that.
Yeah.
And it inspires them. It feeds onto the creative process of the actual scientist and the engineers to create these things that have been dreamed up by science fiction writers. And that, to me, is one of the real appeals to that.
Well, why can't magic do that? You know, I have heard before it said by Valentino, that it was a masked magician, was saying, well, I was exposing magic in order to force magicians into coming up with more and new creative ideas rather than having to lean too much on the history and stuff that is too easy to do and everybody does, and not necessarily the hackneyed lines, but just, you know, cutting a woman in half. I mean, let's move on beyond that. Was, as I understand it, was part of his reasoning for trying to expose it, to force magic into another century.
A wonderful rationalization, of course, but of course. I don't think he had that desired effect. If he, that was his intent, it didn't have that effect.
No, because we haven't. I haven't seen a lot, you know, moved on. In fact, that if you kind of look at some of the same things that we have in Acts today, that the presentations are different, but it's still the same basic elemental effects that General Fitzkey talked about in The Trick Brain so many years ago, in 1927.
So. Unfortunately for Valentino, the writers of the show weren't doing it for that reason, and their attitude towards magic was obviously fairly disdainful. It seemed to me the whole feel of the scripting of that show, the writing of that show was, you know, here it is, it's really stupid and simple when you find out how it's done. You're a fool to have even watched this in the first place.
The first place, right.
That was the feeling I got from it. So I immediately quit watching them. I didn't watch anymore. So people would say, did you see that? And I'd say, no.
What are your thoughts on that? You know, as far as exposing of magic. I mean, you see that on YouTube all the time, you know, where kids are, or say, poor adults, whomever, you know, that you see their hands.
They don't see their faces either when they do it live. They're looking down.
They're looking
you see
down.
The top of their heads.
That's true.
So they're not learning it correctly. And it's okay. I mean, I don't really, there's not much I can say that will do anything, will change anything, but I think that what we need more of in magic is mentoring, personal instruction of passing along what is really important.
Right.
It's not the move, it's not the secret of how the trick works.
Right.
It's how you present it, how you create the experience for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
It's the theater of the magic that, to me, is important.
Right. And how would one go about finding a mentor, do you think?
Ooh, that's tough. That's tough. Because if you're some kid and you just don't know anybody, you don't. But I would say search in your area for magic clubs and find people that are willing to take a chance on a kid. And that happened to me. I had some great mentors, some great teachers. You have too. And this means all the world to what we the way we perform magic today.
Right.
I would say, first of all, for the kids, try some theater. You can find that just about anywhere. Find a director and learn some theater. Be in some plays.
Right.
Have nothing to do with magic.
You can learn how to build props even if you're not in the play. You can learn about
choreography.
They're
always looking for all sorts of technical people.
Yeah.
Sound and lighting.
Yeah.
In your life.
Close up or stage.
It doesn't matter. This is important.
I think it's a good idea, and I'd also suggest that they would study business.
Sure.
You know, because there are a lot of people I know who are very creative, but they can't market their way out of a paper bag, it seems like, you know, that like all these great ideas, but they just aren't focused and can't manage their money or...
I'm a little bit like that myself, so...
Well, that goes back to your wife, you know, Carol and Kathy.
Spoiled
our wives, yeah. Could take care of us in those cases, that's true. But beyond that, in talking about exposing magic, I mean, as a dealer, you know, people come in off the street and, you know, you're showing something.
I'm not really a dealer. I have a few
things
on the website, but mostly I sell at my lectures.
And obviously when you're lecturing, people are coming in who have a desire and they have, or they wouldn't have come there and paid the money or whatever. So you're not, it's not exposure to
teaching
lecture,
is different. And
completely.
A lot of people, there have been some gray areas in this regard of exposure. Is it exposure or teaching? There has to be some sort of investment from the people that you're showing it to for it to be teaching.
Student.
Just laying it out there for everybody to see on the internet is, in my view, more exposure. Although there's
is that a bad thing then, do you think?
I don't think it's totally bad. I'm not for it. I would try not to do it myself. But if someone has an interest in it for a purpose to try to do it, mm-hmm. then I'll teach them. Mm-hmm. I'll tell them how things are done and see a few things and see where they go with that.
Right.
So if they take that and go and write an article, look, I got this magician, the idiot, to tell me how this stuff works.
Yeah.
It's really dumb and stupid. Then I'll know not to show them anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just get them started. So let them know how serious they are in the art. And most people who come and ask me for that advice, they're serious mm-hmm. enough for me to gladly give it, to gladly teach them some magic.
That's kind of a good point, too, that whenever you are teaching somebody, how do you go from a teacher to a mentor? They are serious enough and they have developed enough that I really want to do whatever I can to encourage this enthusiasm.
This happens frequently because you say you have a basic stuff that you teach. I teach my own basic curriculum for mm-hmm. private student. For maybe two or three times.
You really have a curriculum? You don't ask them what they want to do? You actually say, here's what we're going to do.
I sort of ask them what areas they're interested sure. in and why they want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I have a sort of set curriculum mm-hmm. that I do. If they want to learn close-up, I have a set certain number of things. Card magic, I definitely have a set curriculum. If they don't know, or if they want to learn a particular move or sequence or effect, mm-hmm. I'll go with that.
Mm-hmm.
But if they don't have the tools to do it right, then we got to go back a little bit and do a little remedial magic.
Right, right.
So that they understand the tools that they need.
I find that some of the students I have had, some will come in saying, I'm open, I want to learn something, I don't know anything. Others have come in and said, well, I have received these gifts from Christmas or my birthday, and I'd like to learn how to do these. And so...
we have no problem with those specifics. We can do it that either way.
Sure, sure.
So do you keep a set curriculum if you've got somebody that's wide open?
I if they're wide open, then I'll say yes. If you know, I want to find out if it's going to be close-up or is it stage or, is, you know, well, I'm interested in everything. Okay, well, let's start with this because I think if they learn some basics of sleight of hand, that can be carried to the stage, and it's important to understand about hiding, you know, things mm-hmm. and their palming or whatever that can be used then later if they want to do manipulation act or even understanding black art or whatever that it might be or different, you know, misdirection or I should say direction, as Tommy Wonder would say, mm-hmm. to make sure that they're looking in the right place at the right time. There are a lot of theoretical things, but the problem is, I think, with myself included, with just starting out in magic, that you want to learn a trick. You don't want to sit and listen to more theory mm-hmm. about, well, you should be doing this or standing here and doing it. Well, I want to know, you know, how to fool somebody, you know.
Okay, so as an example, like a first lesson, I will teach them a couple of things with cards. I'll teach them a self-working trick that's yeah. very powerful that they can go out and do right away.
Yes.
In the meantime, I'll set them to working on a sleight or a more advanced routine that they'll be practicing but not showing anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Every lesson would tend to have something that's very easy they mm-hmm. can do and progress report or improving their skills on things that take more practice.
I've also
you can do it hand in hand, both of those.
Oh, sure. No, I think I love that idea. It's an excellent idea. I've also found that I feel that three things is about the max that someone can learn in an hour.
People come to me and say, you did the right thing because I wanted to learn everything, and you told me the important things and didn't rush me. Because mm-hmm. if you do more than two or three things per lesson, they're not going to absorb any of it with great depth.
Mm-hmm.
So you want them to get the important things absorbed early on.
Well, I think it kind of goes back just to Zen, you know, that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, you know. So they kind of can come in, it's like, you know, I want to do this and I want to do that. And it's just, okay, you show them a few things, but once they settle down, and then it's like, okay, well, let's now work on something that you will remember and do.
Zen what?
Zen.
Oh, sorry about that. It's an old Flying Karamazov Brothers joke.
Oh, yes. Man, haven't seen him in a long time either. Now, speaking of that, did you ever do any juggling?
Amateur juggling. Nothing professional. Although I have juggled in magic shows.
Yeah.
I learned to juggle the basic cascade, taught sure. myself with a book.
Mm-hmm.
I am actually a member of the Atlanta Jugglers Association,
mm-hmm.
although I would never put juggling on my card.
Yeah,
I know people put magician on their card.
They shouldn't.
They shouldn't, but I know better. So yeah. I could juggle three balls early on when I did children's shows and used to do the old stratospheres trick.
Same thing.
Sure. Well, it's nice to be able to juggle those three balls
right.
as a little quick addition.
That's right.
But I'm not a juggler.
Right. I'm a very amateur juggler. At one time, I was able to do some basic club passing because I had someone that was patient with me with the Jugglers Association
that
would spend some time and help me get over the drive where they're used to throwing to people that can catch anything.
Sure. I found that the pins are the most difficult thing for me to learn because the handles of them that were the heavy ball end, you know, when it come back around, it just busting my fingernails, you know, it just kept hitting my knuckles and fingernails, and it hurt, you know. And I was
got to learn the touch for the throw because the catch is only an easy catch is accomplished by a good throw, right? Of course, juggling is just a matter of throwing up and catching
anyhow.
It.
That's right. Well, in a juggling vein,
yeah.
Going back to stratospheres, did the same thing, you know. And I got have the different colors, and I would throw out a color and then say just throw one back to me, and I would catch it and then go into the cascade then.
But very nice.
Didn't.
So cascade is much easier than people think that don't juggle.
That's right.
Because I could teach just about anyone how to do a cascade in 10 or 15 minutes.
You know, the best way, I think, is with the scarves. Doing scarf
juggling.
Yeah, scarves
are great.
Because it's so slow that you can catch it and catch up with it, and you get the general idea.
Some years ago, Pat Hazel was visiting our home, and he taught my wife, Kathy, how to juggle using a couch.
Basically, you know, kind of kneeling in front of a couch, you know, so that way you don't have so far, because usually when you're juggling, the balls are falling in front of you, and you're trying to keep them, you know, back towards yourself, but also you don't have to reach down to get them if they're falling onto the couch cushion if you're kneeling in front of the couch.
So you got to back this over a bed myself.
Yep, that's a good idea, you know, too, but but with a couch back, you know, it's going to bounce right back to you if you go too far out. It was just he was explaining to her about, you know, opening up a window, basically, that you have the bottom of the pane when you're going to be throwing up to the opposite corner, and as soon as that drops, she kind of caught it within about 15 minutes. You know,
that's right. You've got to keep the pattern in a plane.
Yes.
In front of
you,
a vertical plane.
Yeah.
So I learned from a book, and the way to teach it is very commonly called the Carlo method, because that was the name of the guy who wrote this book on the basic juggling. So I taught myself how to do a cascade by reading this book and simply following the steps the way he laid them out. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I teach it. You start with one ball and
two. So you teach that as part of your classes sometimes?
No, only if I want to teach someone for fun.
Yeah.
How to learn to juggle. Well, I can teach you how to juggle three balls in like 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I prove it.
Yeah.
I got 15 minutes and we got three balls. I'll do it.
Yeah. Going back to your lecture, that you include mentalism, but you have had some mentalism as part of your routine for a very long time. So even though mentalism has gotten to be hot, if you will, over the last,
it's okay
years,
to call yourself a mentalist now. thanks to the character that Simon Baker portrays in the show, The Mentalist.
Yeah, they know what a mentalist is.
Yes,
you know, basically.
So now the mentalists are coming out of the closet. I'm a mentalist.
Yeah, and they know.
Normally,
what that
it means. Was a term we use among each other to say you're a psychic entertainer.
I can say is I'm a mind reader or something.
Or as Banachek is known, as a thought reader. You know, some years ago we had gone to Joe Stevens with our radio magic thing.
Yeah,
that we were,
which was a very good set of tapes. Which I used.
You had been instrumental in helping us sell that, because you had some really great testimonials, and you wrote something in the review for the MUM way back then.
Yes, it's a useful thing, because I've actually had gigs where I needed to do some magic on radio. So
yeah,
I was able to get a couple of great ideas from that.
But we were wanting to do a video way back when. I talked to Joe Stevens with Stevens Magic Emporium when he was doing the video library, magic library. And so I was asking him about that. And he said, mentalism just doesn't sell. You know. And I think at the time, I think they had Larry Becker and Lee Earle. And I don't know, maybe that theirs didn't sell as well as what, you know, Michael Lamars and, you know, Billy McCombs and other, you know.
He probably said, we need something we can sell for $500.
Yeah.
Because we got people out there that'll pay that for whatever.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it is.
That's right. Well, that was, you know, something, you know, going back to the videos, that they really got that started in a mass marketing kind of a way.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
Greater Magic Library.
Greater Magic Library. That's right. Yeah, Joe did a great service, you know, to the magic fraternity, and probably didn't know what a monster he was creating at the time, and then others have, you know, since taken off. Of course, L&L was successful. And then getting up into the YouTube age with everybody being able to market their own magic, you know, online, just
No. You know, it's kind of scary sometimes. You see, sometimes they do it better than you, which you hate them for. Sometimes they mess it up and expose it, which you hate them for, too.
Well, let's say, for an example, the Asher twist. You know, that Lee Asher has a really great routine out there. And if you do a YouTube search for that, I don't know how many dozens of people, you know, it's some are just performing it only, but there are a lot who are trying to show you their way of how they handle it, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're talking about DVDs. I was talking with Cosmo about Real Magic, you know, that he publishes a fantastic bi-monthly.
It's great. It should get a lot more recognition, I think, than it does.
More than it does. He can't be making much money on that because of how much time and effort it takes, you know, certainly with, the high production quality and the quality of material that's on all of those, every episode. You know,
several attempts at video magazine type things.
Yes.
Way back in the VHS days.
Network.
Video Network or something.
That was
MBN. Mm-hmm. Right. That was Ken Norris. I did one of those for him.
Okay.
On a couple of his. So, yeah, that was an early attempt, and it didn't go well either, but it was amazing the amount of magic and reporting. It's like in a magazine, magazine format that you could get for your money.
Yeah.
I don't know why it didn't go any better than it did, but it didn't.
Now, you know, although now Cosmo's been doing this for several years, but my point was going to be just how that no sooner does he put them out, from what I understand, is that people are putting them on torrent and whatever, so he gets ripped off and so many people are stealing, you know, that. I mean, it's immediate that it seems that you can't copyright or patent anything, you know, anymore, and that there have been a lot of controversial
that's a shame.
Things.
Yes, that's the nature of the
people
information
get out,
age.
Just like Steranko. We were talking about, you know, him, you know, getting out of it. You know, you don't see John Cornelius really inventing stuff like he used to. Steve Dushek, you know.
Right. Steve Dushek has been one of the more ripped off people in magic.
Yeah, well, he was just a brilliant creative guy, and probably still is in whatever that he does, but he either keeps it to himself or, you know, just, or is, you know, focused on a different part of the world or whatever that he does. I just haven't heard the name in a while, you know.
Well, that's the lesson to the people who rip off others are not ethical, because you're killing off the creativity, because there's no reason for someone to share their creativity. Mm-hmm. It's simply going to be stolen.
Right. I think that you should be paying for that. That's part of the research and development. I mean, you know, you see these kinds of things. For an example,
Walter Blaney's ladder suspension. People don't know how that it's made, but they have an idea of how they think it might be made. And so in other countries in particular, they will build some sort of a cheap ripoff.
And the problem with that is
they're inferior and they don't work all the way.
Exactly right. And if somebody is injured on that, then he could somehow or another, you know, get sued because, oh, that was a Blaney levitation. Well, no, it wasn't. You know, it was something that you made that was not his. He said, well, it was based on his. Well, you didn't have the plans, you know.
Well, he could defend a suit. It's just a nuisance to do that. But you can sue anybody for any reason.
No, nowadays, it seems like that's
the
case.
What we need is loser pays.
Yeah. Now, let's go in a different direction. I have a question about the Society of American Magicians, you know, and the International Brotherhood of Magicians, that two large organizations. When I talked with Richard Kaufman about Genie Magazine, and he was, we were talking about digital age and whatnot, and I said, what do you think the future of the magazines are? And he said, it's going to be dead. He said, in fact, it's dead now. I mean, he's kind of done everything but, you know, I guess put a fork in it. Said that he thinks that we will soon see the demise, really, of the printed magazine, at least, as even he and Magic Magazine have gone into more digital formats.
I agree with that. It hasn't happened completely yet, though.
No, and it hasn't happened with the IBM and SAM, that is the Linking Ring and the MUM.
But with the advent of iBooks and Kindle and all those things where books are now, book publishing has gone completely, almost, and more so than magazines in that way.
Right.
Where people don't buy books anymore. They just download the stuff to their Kindle or load their.
Well, a few years ago, Stan Allen had mentioned to me that he thought that where we have four major magazines with Genie Magic and Linking Ring and the MUM, that they would probably boil down to just a couple, you know. And here we are, you know, 10 years later, and I haven't seen that necessarily. However, that each of those magazines do have some sort of a digital format type of a thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are, you know,
as a past national president of the Society of American Magicians. But the SAM in particular
has been pretty, aggressive in embracing the digital age. more than the IBM.
Well, I don't think I'm giving away secrets of the National Council by in saying that they do discuss these things. Mm-hmm. They do try to bring the SAM into the present age and the future when they can. They have totally redesigned their website.
Oh, yeah, it's awesome.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't seen it because my password doesn't work and they have to fix some of that.
Okay.
Both organizations, to their credit, mm-hmm. Put a lot of emphasis on the young magicians, on the youth, mm-hmm. because that's the future of magic.
Sure.
And from what I've seen, some of these, not all of the internet age magicians are out there. It's all we've got. We've got some wonderful talent coming up. So
Absolutely. For
that gives me hope that the magic is
yes.
in good hands.
Right.
And we will survive the internet. It will change necessarily. Mm-hmm. Everything has to change.
Including conventions.
Yes. But change is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to adapt to the change.
But do you think the IBM and the SAM will join? I mean, we were talking about this joint convention.
Oh, yeah.
We've had a few of those joint conventions in the past. We're now starting to see more of those. And I'm wondering if the magazines might join, as well as maybe the two organizations. I mean, it's just that both organizations are getting leaner just because they're not having an influx of new members that these younger people, I don't think, to a convention, they don't need an older organization, they don't need the magazine. They can look at it online and
right.
Whatever they want. So
yeah, I understand that, but I understand that necessity eventually, but I don't see it happening in the foreseeable future because of my ties with both organizations.
Sure.
There's still enough of the old guard there that's not going to allow that to happen.
For another generation.
Until there's enough attrition,
yeah.
Yeah. That happens in the organizations.
Mm-hmm.
To do that.
Well, what do you think is going to be the future? I mean, the title of your lecture is Forward into the Past.
Right.
And I mention that because what are you thinking about the future as far as magic and conventions and organizations and magazines and, just kind of...
Well, I mean, I've always tried to think about the future in relation to magic as far as effects go,
mm-hmm.
but as far as surviving the technology changes and the change that we get information, disseminate information, we learn. It's going to be a big change, I think, eventually.
Mm-hmm.
In the future won't be recognizable the way we recognize magic now. It could be something completely different.
Well, who would have envisioned an iPad, 15 years ago even?
Well, science fiction has. Because
exactly. Yeah. Talk about the Minority Report.
Some old movies, and you see something like on Star Trek where they have a clipboard thing.
That's true.
With it. And well, that's an iPad, but this was like
yeah, it was
40
like
years
73,
ago.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah,
amazing. I think that the future. Well, this is one of Arthur C. Clarke's quotations that I like. That he says is not his, but I always thought it was pretty cool. He says, "The future isn't what it used to be." And it's so true, really. The future
yeah.
isn't what it used to be,
yeah.
and it will keep changing, and we don't know what direction. Look at some of the new movies that were supposed to be about the future
yeah.
that went a totally different
funny.
Way.
Yeah.
That was so off-base.
No
now.
Flying cars.
Yeah.
Like Lewis Black had said. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, but again, that you are very much interested in science fiction. You're interested in mysteries. You're interested in puzzles and trying to figure out and thinking about this and have a background in physics. So kind of all that we've been talking about with that, it seems
that you're the perfect person to ask about what's going to happen in the future of magic.
How far into the future we're going to look?
Generation. Let's say a generation now, because say we wash out through you and me, and that we're old and we die, and the next generation has kind of, they're the new leaders now. You know, mm-hmm. who are the younger guys who are the street magicians, I guess, if you will,
I tell you what, I think communication is probably going to change. It'll be more widespread and instantaneous.
Mm-hmm.
And computing power becomes incredible.
It would be the next generation that you will see these, younger people using the communication and computers that will be creating things that are beyond our comprehension than now. So that goes back to the Arthur C. Clarke that you were saying as far as the quote.
Or any good science fiction writer. Now,
yeah.
People like different genres of science fiction. I like the hard science type of science fiction. Now, I would cut my teeth on Ray Bradbury, Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, James mm-hmm. P. Hogan, things like that. And
mm-hmm.
They try to, they understand the science and extrapolate what we know now that we can do with science into the future where we can extrapolate things we know and make it believable. So there's some people say we can never go faster than light. Well, who's to say that there's some other thing we haven't thought of that can allow us to do that? Now, Einsteinian physics tells us we can't, but there may be another type of physics out there. There may be another.
That we're unaware of.
Yeah, that Einstein's theories are an extrapolation of Newton's theories, just taken to another order of terms. So who knows what there's another order. I think Stephen Hawking says that stuff like that that could be another order of science that we aren't even near yet, that can do things we couldn't dream of. And, of course, how drastic would it be if we were able to see forward or back in time, for instance?
Right.
That would change dramatically the future and the past. Who knows?
But if you're looking at something, let's say even as supposedly finite as colors, you know, the rainbow.
Yes.
You know, from black to white and everything, you know, all in between, you know, is there another range or another color that can be found? Or they talk about elements, you know,
of
in
course,
nature.
I mean,
yeah, from other planets or whatever, you know, like that. And so, yeah, that's what I'm just asking about, you know, as far as... I'm sure that we'll be coming up with some other ideas that eventually we're going to be getting... I don't know if we'll ever get away, really, of... you know, cut and restore, or penetration, or transposition. And,
right, you got the basic effects that we say.
Right,
that,
right. But will there be other types of technology to open our minds and our eyes to something that didn't exist before?
Way back in MUM about taking a... sawing a lady in half and using modern technology.
The Wayback Machine, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Wizard.
Okay, Mr. Peabody.
Yeah.
All right, Sherman, go into the way.
Yeah.
And so I said, what if a magician... took, instead of a saw to saw a lady in half or a person in half, take a laser beam like a Goldfinger and saw someone in half. And sure enough, about 6 months later or a year later, David Copperfield did something like that on his TV special.
Sure.
Whether or not he read my column and got the idea, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he's thinking like that in terms of using modern technology to create a...
I think whatever magic we create has to be far enough into the future that people are not saying, oh, it's technology, it's science, it's something I don't understand.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It has to be a step beyond. It can't just be the next step. I think it has to be, it's like in chess, that you have to think two, three, four, six moves ahead as to what's going to happen.
Well, I think the branch of our field now that has the most to gain from the exposure stuff is mentalism, to be honest with you.
Hmm.
I think mental magic is more or less immune to some of this technology thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just now I'm thinking of this. You're making me try to create thoughts on the moment here with this. I could see a whole essay coming out of this myself because of what I'm saying off the cuff with you. But the mental magic has always been something that transcends technology, something that transcends sleight of hand. It has to do with the mind, and it has... much more a chance for that suspension of disbelief amongst people because it's something they believe is possible, something they want to believe in.
That's exactly right.
They have a desire to believe in it.
Along that very line, you know, that I have done dozens and dozens of closing dinners for companies whenever their boards are getting together and they've just, you know, raised an IPO for something. And so they have a lot of fun. They have me come in, and there's only about 15 or 20 people who are from the couple of different boards that have just merged or whatever. And they have a great time. Well, sometimes that I've not been able to perform, and so I have recommended Banachek, and he's come in. The interesting thing is that they have called him back, that is the individual companies. I mean, the investment companies who have contacted me will keep hiring me to have my show that I do for these people. But those companies haven't called me, a few have, to come and do their shows for their companies. But more of them call him to come and do them.
And so I asked these companies why they didn't have me back to work for their companies. And they said, oh, well, we love you.
That's why we keep having you back. It's just that. What you're doing, they know is tricks, it's fun, it's sleight of hand. Don't understand it. It's a lot of fun. They're having a great time. But it's, I guess as Michael Lamar would say, bubblegum for the eyes, you know, kind of a thing. But, you know, what Banachek is doing is something with their minds. These guys work with their minds all day long, and that they're working with, you know, these big figures and, you know, thousands of people, you know, and all different kinds of moving parts and whatnot. And so when he's doing something and getting inside their mind and supposedly understanding and reading their minds through the subtleties that he uses, that he proves that he, beyond a doubt, that he knows what they're thinking, they want to know how he does it and come and do it again, you know, and see if they can, you know, figure it out. So I'm just saying that there seems to be more interest in mentalism because people can't understand that because they want to believe that there really is some
right.
way of
their
mind melding.
Their disbelief is more ready for mentalism.
Exactly. Yeah, more so than just, I mean, they love what we would do as magicians, but...
But mentalism adds another layer to the show.
So do a lot of comedy and other types of magic and mystery type of things. But then, you know, people are laughing, then I do a couple of mind-reading things, and they go, what? Wait a minute. And they can kind of see a completely different direction that I've taken the audience all of a sudden. You know, then I'll end up, after...
I've evolved my performing in the same direction as you have. Uh-huh. More and more towards mentalism, although I prefer to do magic, but the audiences are just eat that up. The mentalism.
Oh, that's true.
You say, well, it's easier. No, it's not easier.
No.
It requires a certain set of skills and theatrical skills.
Like Q&A. I cannot do a Q&A routine.
I don't really do that either.
Well, you know, in your lecture you talk about NLP, neuro-linguistic
right.
programming.
As Kenton Nepper calls, wonder words.
Wonder words. And I think that there is a lot to that in scripting, that you just can't wing it. I think a lot of street magicians, you know, or people who are getting involved in magic, just think that the trick will speak for itself and just watch my hands and this is going to fool you visually. Well, yes, it does. I mean, however, that to make it totally entertaining, I was talking about your lecture, you know, as we were coming back home this evening, about that you add multiple layers. I mean, where you do some voices, you have music, just even the context of a lecture, let alone what your program, I mean, your paid performance would be like when a company hires you to do that. And I think by adding those multiple layers, that just gives you a leg up over what anybody else would be doing. And so by doing some mentalism, that also, I think, adds different layers that the people who are geniuses, my mind just went blank. have the Mensa, thank you. The Mensa groups.
I just pulled that from your brain just now.
You're just reading
my
mind.
My mentalism.
That's right. The Mensa group had asked specifically if I could do a full mentalism show. And I said, sure, you know, because I've got enough stuff. It's just a matter of routining all that, and it was one of those things afterwards that, you know, they really did like, and that was exactly what they wanted, because they wanted to have something that was challenging to their brains. It's just I hadn't tried that before, but I really enjoyed doing that, you know. It was challenging, as I said.
Mm-hmm. Very good. It's right now still, I grew up with magic. I love it. It's
sure.
my vocation and avocation.
I'm and
just
passion.
Can't wean myself off of it.
Yeah.
So it's not my nature. I've done a couple of full only mentalism shows. And I always want to go back to the magic because I can get more laughs, with magic than I can. But
yeah.
You got to do. I do. You probably do a light-hearted type mentalism,
sure.
Not a heavy hitting.
Right.
Lots of humor built in.
Well, Tim Conover used to have a similar kind of a thing. Well, not trying to compare myself to Tim by any means, but I'm just saying that he had comedy, a little levity, as Banachek has a little levity, in there. And I think that you have to. It can't be. Oh, you know, really grinding it out, and I think the number you're thinking of is whatever, you know. It can't be too serious like that. You know, Henning Nelms had talked about, you know, a magic and showmanship, but you have these peaks and valleys and waves, you know.
And this is basic with any type of drama.
Drama,
or theater.
Exactly. Goes back to what you were saying, you know, recommendations for youth to take drama classes and to learn about those peaks and valleys. So you're not just monotone and trying to drill something home, you know.
That's been one of them. I have to keep concentrating on not doing that because once you've learned something and you get a little too slick with it, then you start getting that same level of speech. And so this lecture being more fresh in my mind, it's easier for me to get highs and lows in my expression and my voice. But once you start getting it a little too well learned, you have to go back and concentrate and say, am I doing this now too slick?
Mm-hmm.
Am I making those, leveling off the peaks and valleys too much?
And also, I think freshness. I wrote an article. It's maybe an impromptu line that you heard somewhere and you keep in your show that I think that needs to sound fresh. You know, I love when a person afterwards will say, did you just come up with that? You know, lines. Yeah, sure did. You know, that's the freshness that you want to try to maintain, you know, and that's part of acting, I think.
Right. That's a good subject for writing, and I guess you've done that.
So.
Well, thanks for sharing that, too, because that is a very good point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, we start to wrap up again that I thank you very much for...
I thought we were just getting started. How long has it been? An hour or so?
Well, we've gone into the future already. Yeah, we're going to go back to the future here. Let me, since it's called the magic word.
I had a guy tell me he was going to knock me into next week one time, but...
My podcast is called The Magic Word, and so what is your magic word that you use? Now, that's not necessarily something that you would use for, you know, in your magic show, like Abracadabra. May or may not be something that you live by. It's just, you know, perhaps a credo, something that is important to you, that means something to you.
Well, my slogan has always been, if at first you don't succeed, don't try the Houdini underwater escape.
That was Dan Garrett. And for The Magic Word, this is Scotty out.
One, two, three.
Dear friends, look around now. Choose the nearest exit to your seat. And in case of disturbance of any kind, to avoid the dangers of panic, walk. Do not run to that exit. And now, we ask you all to shift on your sanitary pedestals and join us in that great old hymn, By Order of P.D.